Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Don't Let Go, The Fanatic, After the Wedding, and Itsy Bitsy. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and the Banana Splits movie. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Before we hit the news, I do want to plug my new podcast that you may want to check out. It's called Chubby and Stick. I've talked about it before, and it's a very funny podcast that I'm doing with a good friend of mine, Sterling, who does radio on 700 WLW in Cincinnati. We get together, and since we always tend to derail when we do a little segment or an interview that's ostensibly about movies on the radio down in Cincinnati, it always devolves into insane topics and bizarre discussions about everything and anything. So we decided, hey, let's boil that down to our own little podcast, and you can check that out on the Fat Guys at the Movie site, or you can search iTunes anywhere where you get podcasts for Chubby and Stick. We don't talk about politics. We don't even talk about movies. We don't even talk about sports or anything. You want that? You got that elsewhere on the radio and on the internet. If you want to hear about us doing stupid things to ourselves and each other, then yeah, you can check that out. So Chubby and Stick, check it out on iTunes or through Fat Guys at the Movies and enjoy it and rate it. Give it a good rating. Now into the news, there's a little unfortunate snag that happened in the Disney merger with Fox, where Disney purchased all of Fox, not just as a studio, but all of its back titles as well. Apparently, and I've heard this already happening before from people I know who run repertory houses and screening and independent theaters that will license older movies to be shown, Disney doesn't like to let its stuff be shown too much. They don't allow things to be screened too much because they like to put things back in the vault and then bring them out, and they're pushing for the home video market. Apparently, all of these old Fox titles that used to get yearly screenings, with the exception of Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is really the only way it makes money, is these repertory screenings. All the other ones, Die Hard at Christmas Time, Aliens, any of the stuff that Fox owns, Disney's not allowing that stuff. They're not granting the rights to show that in movie houses at any time of year. And that's a big deal because, like I said, Die Hard, Christmas screenings of Die Hard have become very, very popular. And you can see this now where re-release, it's a Warner Brothers movie, but there was a re-release of The Matrix for its 20th anniversary. That got shown a lot this summer. You see people screening Jaws in swimming pools, and Disney's tightening the reins on this. Now, I don't know how permanent this is going to be. I mean, right now there's a lot of people that are upset in these old theaters that show this stuff. Is this going to loosen up? It might. I have a feeling that Disney is going to treat its back catalog a little differently once I think this is all fallout from what Disney's going to do with all of the Fox titles. They have certain ideas, but I think they've probably felt it was premature to plan Die Hard future and history when they hadn't purchased Fox yet. Now they're going to figure it out, and they're going to say, oh, it actually is going to be worth money to screen Die Hard movies at Christmas. So they'll probably eventually start doing them again. It's just, I think you're going to have this hiccup as Disney sort of streamlines its model and absorbs the Fox brand and figures out where these things are going to go. I don't think, and there's this, people love the narrative of Disney being this big, huge, evil behemoth. And yeah, they own a lot of stuff. And yeah, they have also grown by acquisition, but this stuff can change on a dime. I mean, 10 years from now, Disney may not be as big as they are now. I mean, 20 years ago, you had different studios on the top of the heap. So we'll see. I wouldn't get too worried about the future of this Disney stuff with the Fox films. The next piece of news I want to hit is The Irishman, which is Martin Scorsese's latest film. That's come in and clocking in at about 3.5 hours. And that's okay. I mean, Martin Scorsese, I believe, has earned it to do these movies. And he's done long movies before. It's not like he does these breezy 90-minute larks. I mean, he's done longer films. You know, Casino was, I think, 3 hours or more. And I mean, so we've had these films before. I think it's okay. I don't think I have to balk at a 3.5 hour running time, especially when you hear how it's going to go down. I'm probably going to end up seeing it in the theater for award consideration, but there's only a 3.5 week theatrical window. It's doing limited releases, and then it's going to drop on Netflix. I think they're going for the Oscar buzz the same way Roma doggone near won the Oscar last year. So you're going to see that happen. And we're going to be talking about a little bit more about that sort of business model here in the trailer park. But the other thing I want to talk about really quickly is there's a Breaking Bad movie that got announced this past weekend, which is going to follow the character of Jesse. The movie's going to be called El Camino. It's going to be dropping on Netflix. I don't think it's going to be going for the Oscar the way The Irishman is. But the big thing is you're going to get stuff that happened to Jesse post Breaking Bad. And I think that's what, I mean, you know what happened to Walter White, but you want to see where Jesse ended up. And I'm curious about that. But of course, I'm also hoping it's not too much fan service. And at least they didn't make it into a big, long, sprawling TV series that takes 6 episodes just to find Jesse. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to touch on is The Rise of Skywalker. It's a new teaser. And this is, of course, for the new Star Wars movie opening on December 20th.
We've passed on all we know. A 1,000 generations live in you now. Your fight. Your journey nears its end.
Now, this one got a lot of buzz because it was released at Disney Expo, and they have a poster, which is a fantastic poster, by the way. Not the one with everybody's face, the Drew Sirza-style poster that we've all seen for years, but the new one where it shows Rey and Kylo Ren fighting on a cliff. The big thing that people are buzzing about is the fact that Rey shows up with a red lightsaber. I don't want to read too much into that. I think that Disney in its own might be taking a move from Marvel, where Marvel has put fake stuff in the trailers or stuff that doesn't necessarily follow the story in the trailers just to throw you off or just to not give stuff away. And I'm all for that. This is also a teaser trailer. It looks like it's revealing about as much as the first teaser trailer has. And that's fine. I am probably going to go dark on this stuff until the movie comes out, because I don't want to get the whole thing spoiled in what happens in this film. Also interesting to note, Rose Tycho shows up nowhere in that trailer. The next one I want to hit really quickly is The Report, which opens on November 15th in limited release and then gets a Amazon Prime release on November 29th in a smaller theatrical window than The Irishman.
Morning, Dan.
Morning, Senator.
Have you seen the story today in the New York Times?
Evidently, the CIA destroyed tapes of interrogations of Al-Qaeda detainees.
I want to find out what was on the tapes and why they were destroyed.
I vehemently disagree with the narrative here.
The United States does not torture.
Dan, you need to be careful here.
They can't destroy the documents. They can go after the next best thing, you.
What they really did was make it impossible to prosecute.
This is one of those movies that's looking back at the breakdown of post 9/11 politics, and not necessarily the in the front politics of voting here and there, but sort of the behind the scenes of the politics behind the politicians. And it's looking at the oversight report on whether or not the CIA was torturing prisoners, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what's interesting about this is because it's been long enough from that to have happened. Whenever you make a movie that takes place within the confines of current events, it's very hard to look objectively at it. The farther and farther away you get, the more objectively you can look. That's why you didn't really start getting movies that looked at the Vietnam War properly until 10, 15, 20, 30 years after Vietnam ended. And I think you're getting the same thing here. When this was post 9/11, there was not the time to make these movies because it was so polarizing. Here you can look back and say, okay, well, this was right or this was wrong. The same thing with The Post. If you remember The Post from, was it last year or the year before, where it was looking at the examination of the federal government as it pertained to Vietnam, and you're looking at it 40 years later, so it gives you a different perspective, you know, without being embroiled in the current political scene. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Don't Let Go and Itsy Bitsy. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's kick off the movie reviews with the only, like, brand new wide release, and that is Don't Let Go. An L.A. detective receives a call from his favorite niece who died 2 weeks before, giving him the chance to stop the murder from happening before it begins.
Who is this?
Who do you think it is?
Where are you calling from?
I'm at my house.
What's the date today?
It's June 25th.
Believe it or not, I'm sitting right here. 2 weeks in the future.
But I don't understand.
There's a crime that in your time hasn't yet happened. Your dad's gonna die. Your mom's gonna die. And so are you. But as long as you're alive, you can change things.
This is the only wide release, the brand new wide release, and it's from a relatively new studio. I'm not familiar with it, OTL Studios or something like that. And that's why it probably wasn't screened widely. A lot of times these smaller, piddly movies and from piddly studios don't get full wide screenings. And I'm like, okay, I'll give that the benefit of the doubt because they did not show it to me at a screening in Cleveland, but I wasn't going to go up for this. So I went ahead and saw it on the Thursday night previews. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it'll be pretty good. You know, it's got David Oyelowo in it, and I think he's a very talented actor. It's got Alfred Molina in it, and I actually kind of like the premise. It's kind of like a Twilight Zone, and it's funny because I've been rewatching the entire Twilight Zone series, the original one from 1959 through the early 60s. So I'm getting into the Twilight Zone stories, and I've always found those to be kind of fun stories anyways. This one, of course, has that type of setup where it's a call from the past. It also reminds me of a movie called Frequency, which came out, oh gosh, about 20 years ago. It's one of my wife's favorite movies. And it stars Jim Caviezel and Dennis Quaid. And they have like a two-way radio, like a CB. And because of like sunspot activity or something, they end up being able to talk to each other over the span of like 20 years. And it's to solve his mother's murder. So I'm like, oh, it's been done before, this kind of idea. I'm like, oh, this might be kind of cool. So I'm starting to watch the movie and, you know, like the first 20 minutes seems interesting, but it doesn't play out the way it does in the trailer, which you hear, which I'm okay with. I don't mind if they futz around with a trailer just to make it work to give you the setup of the story. But the whole point is that this detective finds, his niece and her family murdered and has to go try and stop her when he starts getting calls from her. And so it has that nice setup, but the problem is, there's not much more past that setup. It then becomes him trying to have her solve her own murder because, of course, they don't know who killed the family. So he's trying to point her in the right directions and he's trying to get evidence from the police station because, of course, he has access to that as a detective. You know, even though I don't know if they would allow him access to the evidence of his family because he might be a little too personally close to that stuff. But there's not much more than that. And then it runs in circles and goes back and forth. And I realize that's why it feels like a Twilight Zone episode would have worked for a 30-minute TV series in the 1960s. But trying to stretch it out to an hour and a half, or actually an hour 45 minutes, I think is the running time. But it feels like it's pacing its time and it kind of turns in on itself. And it takes forever for him to actually say, hey, I'm from the future and you're dead and I'm trying to help. You know, at certain point, it's just, he's just waiting for her next call. And it seems like it's a neat little half hour idea that got expanded to an hour and a half. And then, of course, the resolution full of cliches, completely predictable from frame one. And when they get to the conclusion, they draw that one out forever. It felt like Return of the King. It just kept not ending forever. So this was, and then it also is like weirdly brutal. That's one of my problems with some of these cop dramas where it could be an interesting thing, but they say, well, let's just make it needlessly brutal or needlessly skeezy or needlessly gritty. And that kind of turns me off. So overall, even though it's got a good cast, it sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another review. It's a smaller film called Itsy Bitsy, and it comes from Shout Factory, which does more than just release awesome DVDs and Blu-rays of like old classic horror movies from the 80s that I grew up with. This is a brand new one, and it is, I believe it's in some theaters. You can certainly see it in some theaters, but most of the way you're going to see this is on demand. A struggling single mother takes a job as a live-in caregiver where a giant mythical spider has hatched.
Well, this is it. Our new home sweet home.
Looks like no one's been here for a while.
This is really dusty.
Here, kitty, kitty. I got some nice tasting tuna right there for you.
This one also has kind of an impressive cast, not the woman who plays the single mother, but it has Denise Crosby as the sheriff, and it's got Bruce Davison as the guy who's the invalid who she's taking care of, and of course he's known as the senator from the X-Men, or he was in Willard way back in the 70s, you know, the one about the rats. There's some things I really appreciated about this movie. The first thing is it felt like a movie. A lot of times these low budget or smaller budgeted horror movies feel like a student project, and the acting doesn't quite work, and the set design and the camera work is a little bit cheesy or very low rent. It looks like people were shooting it on the weekend. This looks professional, and it helps having two actors in it that are very good, but even the other actors in it hold their own. Even they got little kids in there, and the kids do a decent job. It also, I'm impressed with the special effects. The spider looks real. It has some CGI, but it also has some practical effects of the spider. Now, the spider's not huge. It's like the size of like a German Shepherd. So it's not like the size of a Volkswagen, or it's not like Tarantula where it's the size of a building. It's, you know, but still, I don't like walking in and finding a spider that's the size of a quarter, let alone the size of a dog. So it's creepy enough, and it moves around. If you don't like spiders, you know, like the creepy crawlies, it's unnerving. But it is somewhat restrained because it is just this one spider, and it has its moments, and it creeps around, and it is creepy and scary, and it'll make your skin crawl, but it's not overdone. That's actually something I liked about it, is you didn't have the scene where it was one spider and then a kajillion baby spiders come pouring over people that are obviously overdone CGI. It's this one creepy looking spider that works. And there's actually there's one scene in particular with this sort of suspense of somebody trying to save somebody else, and they have to be quiet because the spider's in the background. That works really well. Where the movie has problems for me is in the character development, particularly of the single mom, because she's such a terrible mother. She's given this backstory that I find unnecessary. I mean, why do they be like, well, we need to have her struggling? She's a single mom trying to save her kids from a dog-sized spider. Isn't that enough to worry about? No, no, no. We have to give her this background where she's had another kid die in a car accident and hooked on pain medication. I'm just like, the flashbacks and all that, that just felt like unnecessary padding. But the creature moments and the relationship between the invalid and the kids, I think actually they could have developed that more. I thought that was kind of interesting. But, you know, the overdeveloped her character into not a very nice person is hard to have sympathy for her, even though you want to have sympathy for the kids. But still, you know, for sort of that smaller budgeted creature feature, it kind of works. So I'm going to have to say Itsy Bitsy kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Fanatic and After the Wedding. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. The first one in this segment is a smaller film. Both of these are smaller films, just like Itsy Bitsy was. Itsy Bitsy, you're going to probably have a hard time finding that in too many theaters, but you will find it online as an on-demand thing. Now, these, I believe The Fanatic is online in an on-demand thing. After the Wedding is doing a small rollout in theaters from Sony Pictures Classics. But the first one I want to hit is The Fanatic. And this one is directed by Fred Durst from Limp Bizkit. And he's done some dabbling into film, not just acting, but also in directing and producing, I believe. John Travolta plays a passionate fan of an actor whose obsession becomes dangerous.
Is Hunter Dunbar here tonight?
That's enough.
I need to get an autograph. Don't let him do this to me.
I'm a fan. I'm a number one fan.
Is it difficult to find famous people's houses?
I use my StarMap app. You have to be careful. I don't want you to be accused of stalking.
Hey, you can't just come to my private residence looking for me.
Listen, pal, I don't know how you found me, but I don't ever want to see you in this neighborhood again.
This is not a remake of either The Fan from 1981 or The Fan from 1996, 1997. It's written by Durst, but it is sort of the same type of story as we had with the other two movies, The Fan. Even The Fan from 1981 and the one from the 90s, those are not remakes of each other, even though they have the same name. I mean, The Fan from 1981, that's the one with Lauren Hutton playing an actress and Michael Biehn going crazy and going after and killing people around her. And then, of course, The Fan from the Tony Scott movie from the 90s, that one had Robert De Niro as a baseball fan, obsessed with Wesley Snipes' character. So they all kind of fit that same model of just a deranged fan. They just call this one The Fanatic, which, by the way, that's what fan is short for. The most interesting thing about this movie really is John Travolta's performance in it. I'm actually kind of impressed with him in this. I mean, it is a little bit dismissive, and it's funny. I remember seeing this movie a day or two before I saw Peanut Butter Falcon last week, and even although the characters are very different, and they're very different types of movies, and it's not that the character that John Travolta plays in The Fan is the same. I mean, he doesn't have Down syndrome or anything like that, but it's clear that the guy has some mental capacity issues. The character he plays is a guy named Moose, and they've got him talking a little bit simplistically at times and acting a little bit simplistically, and you wonder if he has some mental deficiencies. And at first when I saw The Fanatic, I'm like, oh, okay, I like his performance. I think it's different. And it still is interesting because it's something different than what John Travolta has played in the past. But after I saw Peanut Butter Falcon and was talking to the producer of that last week, I was like, yeah, I guess this is a little bit dismissive of the mentally challenged because you're making that person a bad guy. And it does kind of go to show you how many times that sort of issue has been used as a character trait of bad guys. I mean, going all the way back to John Steinbeck's of Mice and Men, where you've got one of the characters is he accidentally kills somebody because doesn't have the mental capacity to understand that he actually kills this person. So this has been done a lot, and it is somewhat, it is a little bit jarring and abrasive when I saw these two movies together and I'm like, do we really have to go down that path that because he's got mental issues, he can accidentally kill somebody and not realize it? The thing that's interesting about the movie is it's made by a full-blown celebrity. I mean, you got Fred Durst from Limp Bizkit is the one who, makes the film. And it's clear he's making a statement about fans that he's probably seen. I'm assuming, because it felt like that he's venting his spleen about how intrusive fans can be. And some of them can really be intrusive. But he then completely derails off that message because the guy, Devin Sawa, who plays the actor that Moose is all obsessed with, that guy's a real jerk. And that guy doesn't handle himself well. And he doesn't de-escalate situations when they occur. When like Moose shows up at his place, he gets all mean and threatening and everything instead of coming out and saying to him, hey, look, man, you really can't do this. And you're breaking a social taboo. If you come back, I'm going to have to call the police. No, he's ready to like fight the guy or something like that. Even when they're at an autograph session and it just shows that this character that Sawa plays is so knee jerk to react to this stuff that he doesn't know how to just settle the situation down and deal with things. He just attacks and attacks immediately. But the whole movie completely unravels in the last act. I mean, completely, it just spirals out of control. It's sort of like if you ever, got one of those firecrackers, the snakes that you light on fire and it turns into this big, looks like a flaming pile of turd. And that's basically what the movie does. It's just kind of bulbs up all over the place. It does this, it does that. And none of it actually fits together. The other thing the movie does that's really, really noticeable as an amateur mistake is it's got this character that narrates. And when you listen to it, you're like, there was no reason to have this narration. Narration's okay if it's necessary. But you always got to say, usually it's not. But it's like a friend of Moose's who's a paparazzi, and that's how he finds where this guy lives. The reason to see this movie is for Travolta's performance, because I found it quite interesting. But aside from that, it just doesn't hold together. It starts off interesting, and I was curious to see where it went. The problem is that it just completely unravels and collapses by the end of the film, that it's just not a satisfying ending. And I think partly is because Durst is way too close to the subject material in a lot of ways. So I'm going to have to say The Fanatic kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with After the Wedding. A teacher from India returns to America for a fundraising trip only to discover that her benefactor has some alarming ties to her past.
I'm really sorry about that. You just caught me at a very busy time. My daughter's getting married this weekend. Come to the wedding, we can get to know each other better.
Hi, good, you made it.
Isabel runs an orphanage in India that I'm thinking of funding.
Oh.
Yeah.
What are you doing here?
I didn't know. Hi.
Isabel, right?
I told you that I would call you.
But you didn't.
This is strange to see Oscar again.
I did a review of this on the radio a couple days ago. And I didn't realize how much the producers of this movie were trying to keep it secret as to all the twists and turns. And the problem is, how do you explain this movie without giving away some of it? Because there's, otherwise it's just this awkward interpersonal drama between these three people if you don't know what the actual surprises are. And it's funny, on the radio in this earlier interview, I basically told the big surprise, and then I went and watched the trailer, and for the first time in my life I saw a trailer that gave away less than it should have. It doesn't give away anything. It's just like, oh, this Michelle Williams plays this teacher, and she goes to talk to Julianne Moore, who's this wealthy millionaire, and she's married to Billy Crudup, and oh, they had a relationship, and we can't tell you any more about that, but it's really cool. You're going to want to see it. This is a remake of a Danish film, and in some ways, when you watch it, you're like, oh, it has these certain elements of Scandinavian cinema, the sort of heavier, more morose, sometimes impossibly uncomfortable social issues in there. And I can see where the origin comes from. It also wraps up almost ghoulishly too well at the end. It's sort of like The Fanatic. This movie has some great performances in it. I mean, Julianne Moore's fantastic and Michelle Williams fine. I'm not a huge fan of Michelle Williams, but I think Julianne Moore's quite great in it. And I think that Billy Crudup holds his own between two strong actors. But part of the problem is the characters. I don't like the characters. They're all kind of a-holes. Julianne Moore's characters you're supposed to be sympathetic for, and then she turns into a, you know, biatch. And Michelle Williams' character, she's supposed to be sympathetic, but then you're like, look at what she did and what gets her in this situation. You're just like, well, you were a moron and you've lost your high ground because you were sort of reprehensible beforehand. And now you're blaming Billy Crudup's character for not telling you something, but you're just like, well, wait, he did the right thing. He actually did a righter thing than what would have been the alternative. So, you know, it's one of those movies that, and again, I'm kind of dancing around the issue because when I watch the trailer, I realize, oh, the studio doesn't want this much information given about the movie. But yeah, it's not worth seeing for the twist. I mean, really, if you're a fan of the actors, it's maybe worth it. But I don't know. It just doesn't. Maybe someone was lost in translation. They also gender flipped a lot of the roles just to, I guess, be cool. And then you kind of have to jump through some story hoops to get to the situation. But I still, I'm going to have to say After the Wedding kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and the Banana Splits movie. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr for our final segment. We are going to move ahead into the box office now, since we did all the movie reviews for such a scant weekend. I mean, it's Labor Day weekend. And Labor Day weekend, if you don't know, it's notorious for being one of the lowest grossing box office weekends of the year. And it's weird because you'd think that Memorial Day and Labor Day are very similar. They're 3-day weekends. They book in the summer. And you'd be like, wow, they should kind of have a similar pull in terms of movies. But, you know, Memorial, it used to be when I was a kid, Memorial Day opened the summer season. Now they do it in May and April, even with the Avengers movies. And then you think, well, wouldn't Labor Day, it's a 3-day weekend, it's a big holiday, people do cookouts, all that kind of stuff. It's a little bit different. A couple things that cause that is because when you release a movie on Labor Day weekend, it has nowhere to go. I mean, it just heads into September and you can't do a 4-quadrant movie because all the kids are going back to school. And it's not just going back to school. Back in May, things are wrapping up from school. Here, you're getting kids doing auditions and they're doing sports tryouts. If you're in marching band, you're again rehearsing. So all that free time you have at the end of the day in the end of the school year is bottled up. Now, of course, this is all going to be blown to heck when it comes out next week and completely shatters box office records. And last weekend, it was actually somewhat surprising. Angel Has Fallen came in with 21 million plus that over the weekend, which is good enough for it to do. But none of these movies this week are going to come even close to that. And Angel Has Fallen is going to drop, you know, 50, 60, maybe 50%. So you're looking for an entire weekend where nothing's going to crack 15 million. You know, Good Boys is going to hold on, but still it was 11 and a half last week. Overcomer did okay, 8 million. But again, you're looking at stuff starting to drop off fast. And then Ready or Not did about 8 million, which is a little disappointing. I would have liked to have seen more. The Peanut Butter Falcon, yeah, that one was out of the top 10 with about 3 million, but still 3 million is not bad for a movie like that. I think it was like a $5 million production. So at least something like The Peanut Butter Falcon is getting a certain degree of love from audiences. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. First one I want to talk about is Godzilla, King of the Monsters. A group of scientists and military men uncover other sleeping kaiju that awaken and battle Godzilla for supremacy of the Earth.
Senators, we believe that these titans are just the tip of the iceberg. Which of these titans are here to protect us? And which of these titans are here to threaten us?
They're everywhere.
Battling for dominance. A rival alpha to Godzilla.
You gotta be kidding.
This was a movie I saw this summer, and I thought it was way better than the reviews it got. I had so many issues with the 2014 Godzilla reboot, because it was not about Godzilla. And I know that some critics thought that was neat, that, oh, they can focus on the characters and the humans. But I'm like, the heck with the human drama. Give me the kaiju fights. And they kept cutting away from the kaiju fights. This one, they said, doggone it, we are going to have kaiju fighting end to end from the trailers to the credits. I mean, that's what I wanted to see. And you get that. Now, Godzilla takes a while to show up. But yeah, you've got all these other Mothras like Ghidorah and Rodan and Mothra. I mean, and plus they pull up a whole bunch of other ones just randomly throughout, you know, giant mammoths and spiders and all these really fun things that you're getting ready for this Monster Universe Smackdown. Now, this didn't do as well. And unfortunately, it didn't do as well overseas, because that's where kaiju movies tend to do well. But, you know, I say you got to kind of blame that not on this movie, but the last movie, Godzilla 2014. Maybe people didn't want to go see a new one because they thought it was going to be as boring and as lame as the 2014 Godzilla. So this movie's a lot of fun, and it has some great actors in it. And yes, all they're doing throughout the entire movie is running around reacting to these kaiju fighting. It almost doesn't even matter what the actors are doing, but it's got some great actors in it too. You got Sally Hawkins, you got Vera Farmiga, Ken Watanabe. It's fun. If you want to see a Monster Smackdown, that's what you've got. And it makes me just super excited to see Kong versus Godzilla, or Godzilla versus Kong, whichever one gets top billing. I don't know. Let's get Don King in there and kind of figure it out. I mean, I loved Kong Skull Island. I thought it gave a unique look at what a King Kong movie could be. And I thought this was a great next step. I'm looking forward to the MonsterVerse. I just hope these movies don't become so expensive they become cost prohibitive. Just even the composition of this is sort of could be a masterclass in epic composition of some of the scenes. I mean, some of the shots of Godzilla shooting his fiery breath in the air, or Ghidorah coming out of a volcano with a cross in the front. I mean, it has some really interesting imagery in here. It's a beautiful looking movie, and it just, special effects wise, is flawless. So I'm going to have to say that Godzilla King of the Monsters totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue the home cinema roundup with the Banana Splits movie. Now, this is interesting because this didn't come out of the normal Warner Brothers pipeline of films that I review. I actually made a special request because I'm like, this is really interesting. I'm curious to see this movie. They sent me a free Blu-ray to watch. And so, but this is my own opinion. I mean, trust me, I've been sent plenty of free Blu-rays and trashed them. So during the taping of the popular Banana Splits TV program, the animatronic characters come to life on their own and start a violent killing spree.
Who's excited to see the Banana Splits? Yeah!
Rebecca! Rebecca! I'm canceling the show.
What?
Hey, kids, put on your happiest faces because the Banana Split Show is about to begin.
Breaking up on Why are you doing this to me?
Now the show can go on forever and ever.
I do not remember the Banana Splits because they came out a couple years before I was born, but I do remember reruns of them. And then I remember back in the early 2000s watching Boomerang had a bunch of stuff from the 70s. I'd watch these old 70s cartoons with my kids when they were really young. And we'd watch the Banana Splits and we loved the song and we loved the Dickies cover of the song. And it's just so goofy. It's that weird 70s almost psychedelic level of Sid and Marty Krofft muppetry. And it's such a bizarre, the Banana Splits in particular, they really have this, feels like there's a lot of connective tissue to the band that was in Chuck E. Cheese and Showbiz Pizza Place back in the 80s. This is before it became a little kids show at Chuck E. Cheese, where it was all just like games for 5-year-olds. Back when they had bona fide video games and, Dragon's Lair and Robotron and Pac-Man and Dig Dug and all that great classic 80s arcade stuff, it really feels like the Banana Splits in an alternate timeline could have become one of those animatronic bands at a pizza shop. And I remember rewatching the Banana Splits. The only thing that really bothered me about this is I wish the movie broke into an episode of Danger Island in the middle. If you recall, Danger Island was the Banana Splits themselves originally, they were just like an anthology series where they would have these host segments and it would introduce cartoons and episodes of Danger Island, which were these like 5-minute, I think Richard Donner actually directed Danger Island. The guy who directed Superman, the movie, and the Lethal Weapon films, he directed the Danger Island segment, which was a jungle adventure. It was like serial, like what you'd watch in the theaters when, in the 40s. But in this movie, the Banana Splits continued on and now they're animatronic. They're not people in suits. But, and it's sort of like this forgotten kid show that still exists and still has a cadre of fans. But when the lights go out, of course, the animatronic characters come to life and a glitch happens in their system. And very much like that new Chucky movie, only done much better. And then, of course, they go on this killing spree and it gets violent. I mean, it is a bona fide slasher movie. And I think that it took a lot of stones to take what is ostensibly a beloved kids show, albeit forgotten, and turning it into a monstrous horror movie. Now, it does feel a little bit low rent. It's certainly shot on a budget, and they do cut some corners, at least in terms of acting and scripting. But for the slasher movie kills, it's as good as any other, Jason or Michael Myers movie. And it's the fact that these are the actual characters and designs doing it that I think is really just a lot of fun, because I don't think it's trampling on anyone's childhood. I mean, not currently. No one's watching the Banana Splits. You don't have 5-year-olds watching the Banana Splits. This isn't like having Dora the Explorer putting on a hockey mask and hacking people up. So yeah, the Banana Splits movie is a lot of fun and it's not for the weak of stomach, but it is a great way to look at elements of the past. I'd love to see a whole series of Banana Split movies. And it does open itself up for a sequel. I'd love to see something like Snorky's Revenge. The Banana Splits movie totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also out this week on DVD and Blu-ray include Rocket Man, The Secret Life of Pets 2, Apocalypse Now, the final cut in 4K, Stand By Me in 4K, The Flash Season 5, and V, the original miniseries on Blu-ray. And that is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about It Chapter 2. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.